Always find that list at kaxc.org. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. There is more ahead from Morning Edition.
Good morning. President Trump says he's not going to war with Chicago after posting online that Chicago is about to find out why it's called the Department of War. How is the city responding? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Jordan says Israel is charging trucks delivering aid to Gaza hundreds of dollars each in customs fees. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. There are already far too few aid trucks being allowed into Gaza to prevent more starvation, according to the World Food Program. Also, political crisis in France. The fifth prime minister since 2017 is likely to fail a no-confidence vote as France struggles with massive debt. It's Monday, September 8th. On this day in 1974, President Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon for any crimes he may have committed during the Watergate break-in and its cover-up. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says he doesn't want to go to war in American cities. This comes after he posted an image of himself over the weekend, sitting in front of a picture of the Chicago skyline with helicopters and flames behind him. The post invoked the Vietnam War film Apocalypse Now. Trump also said Chicago was about to find out why it's called the Department of War, his alternate name for the Department of Defense. Now Trump says his administration is not going to war, but will clean up cities so there are no murders. And he would not say when troops might go into the Illinois city.
We could solve Chicago very quickly, but we're going to make a decision as to where we go over the next day or two.
Huge crowds of people turned out in Chicago over the weekend to protest Trump's plans to deploy federal troops to Chicago and boost immigration operations. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker said that his state would not be, quote, intimidated by a wannabe dictator. Jury selection begins today in Florida for the man charged with attempting to assassinate then-candidate Donald Trump last year. A Secret Service agent says he spotted Ryan Ruth holding a rifle and fired on him while Trump was golfing at his West Palm Beach club in September. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
A witness says he saw Ruth running from what prosecutors call a sniper's nest in the tree line near Trump's golf club in West Palm Beach. Ruth was arrested a short time later driving north on the interstate. Ruth faces five charges, including attempting to assassinate a major presidential candidate, which carries a maximum sentence of life. He'll be representing himself in court. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon granted Ruth's request to dismiss his federal public defenders, but said they will remain on standby. Last week, Judge Cannon denied Ruth's request to subpoena President Trump, saying his motion contained, quote, various insults and no pertinent facts. Greg Allen, NPR News, Fort Pierce, Florida.
A UN agency says postal traffic to the U.S. has fallen significantly. That's after the Trump administration suspended a trade exemption rule in late August. NPR's Chantalise Duster has more.
The Universal Postal Union says postal traffic to the U.S. came to a near halt, dropping 81% after August 29th. That's when the de minimis trade exemption that allowed packages worth less than $800 to be exempt from tariffs ended. At least 88 postal operators have suspended some or all services to the U.S. until there is a solution, the union says. The agency also says it is working on ways to get postal traffic flowing back to the U.S. The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment, but the Trump administration has defended ending the trade exemption as a way to crack down on counterfeit products and fentanyl entering the country. Chantalise Duster, NPR News.
President Trump speaks to the Religious Liberty Commission today in Washington, D.C. He'll give remarks at the Museum of the Bible. This is NPR. Israeli police say gunmen have killed at least six people in Jerusalem today. They opened fire at a bus stop in a large intersection that leads to Jewish settlements in East Jerusalem. The gunmen were shot by a civilian and a security officer. Hamas has praised the shooting. The U.S. Department of Transportation says it will train more than 160 new railroad bridge inspectors. This will expand federal and state oversight of more than 70,000 railroad bridges in the country. Reporter Lex Doig has more.
The announcement follows an Associated Press report produced by the Howard Center for Investigative Journalism at Arizona State University that found the Federal Railroad Administration had just six employees overseeing railroad bridge safety. This allowed companies to largely inspect themselves with little oversight. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said his agency will now train existing federal and state track inspectors to also inspect railroad bridges. Those workers will be able to recommend civil penalties for companies when defects are found. The rail union SMART-TD said on its website the development is a clear step forward in addressing rail workers' safety concerns, saying, though, quote, there is more work to be done. For NPR News, I'm Lex Doig.
Spaniard Carlos Alcaraz won the U.S. Open men's tennis tournament yesterday. He defeated top opponent, Italian player Jannik Sinner. Alcaraz is now the top men's tennis player in the world. On Saturday, Aryna Sabalenka successfully defended her title, repeating as the winner of the women's U.S. Open tennis tournament. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
A lot of times you just need to listen.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
I'm Eric Alness, and I'm a veteran. My career started in 1986 when I went off to the Military Intelligence School at Fort Huachuca, Arizona for 6 months to become an intelligence officer. Working for Major General Larry Shelato was a great pleasure. When I was doing legislative work, he gave me a lot of latitude. So really work hard on trying to get a really robust package of things that'll help service members be successful. Probably one of the big signature acts from that was the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program. That's probably saved a lot of lives since it passed in the 2007-8, I would imagine. They have family assistance centers throughout the state that are operating throughout the business week and extended hours when needed that provide those assistance to families that maybe the units can't provide.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by EMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump is dialing back his threats against Chicago after an explosive post on social media over the weekend that many interpreted as a plan to wage war on the city.
The president has vowed to step up immigration raids and send the National Guard to a number of American cities led by Democrats.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf is in Chicago. Kat, you've been there for the past few days. What happened over the weekend?
Yeah, so on Saturday, Trump posted this pretty remarkable meme on social media you just referred to. It's an AI image of him as a character from the 1979 Vietnam War film Apocalypse Now. And it shows Chicago burning with helicopters flying overhead. And it says, Chicago about to find out why it's called the Department of War. He's referring there to his rebranding of the Department of Defense last week. And that got a lot of attention, especially from elected officials here. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker responded by posting, quote, the President of the United States is threatening to go to war with an American city. This is not a joke. This is not normal. But then on Sunday, Trump was asked by a reporter if he was threatening war with Chicago. And here's how he responded.
We're not going to war. We're going to clean up our city. We're going to clean them up so they don't kill five people every weekend. That's not war. That's common sense.
Data shows that violent crime is down in Chicago in recent years, but Trump maintains that the National Guard will be sent here and to other cities to fight crime. He's also threatened to step up immigration arrests and deportations.
All right, so that's the view from D.C. How are people feeling in Chicago?
People are still going about their daily lives, but it is tense. On Saturday, there was a big protest downtown with marchers taking up whole streets for blocks. I talked to people there, and they told me that they were really worried about American democracy, especially after they've seen Trump deploy National Guard troops in both L.A. and D.C. in recent months. On the immigration side of things, people are genuinely scared. I went to Pilsen. It's a neighborhood where many people with Mexican roots live on the west side. I talked to 27-year-old Andrea Soria there. She teared up a bit, telling me about several undocumented members of her family who haven't left their houses this week.
for them to not be able to go out. And all this week, they've been relying on myself, you know, go get groceries, go check on this.
And she said it's been really stressful.
Now, Trump has said he will send the National Guard cat. He just hasn't said when or where. Wasn't there a ruling last week, if I remember right, saying that Trump's deployment of troops to Los Angeles this summer was illegal?
Yeah, you're right. That judge found that Trump's use of the National Guard violated a law that limits the use of the military for domestic law enforcement. But that ruling, which the Trump administration has appealed, only applies in California. In D.C., where the National Guard has been deployed for about a month, Trump has the authority to do so because of how enmeshed the federal government is with D.C. In most cases, governors deploy their state National Guards. You know, many experts say that what we're seeing here, with it being potentially forced on states, is uncharted territory.
Okay, so what are you going to be watching for in the coming days?
Well, we still really don't know what Trump's going to do. Remember, Trump has threatened multiple cities. Yesterday evening, he left things open, saying he would make a decision about where to send federal troops and agents, quote, over the next day or two. When asked specifically if he has plans for Chicago this week, he said, no, not really.
All right, that's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Chicago. Kat, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So how far can President Trump go when it comes to deploying troops to American cities? To discuss this, I'm joined by University of Chicago law professor Craig Futterman. He specializes in policing and public safety. Good morning, Craig, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Layla.
So let's start with that question. How far can the president go legally with what he plans to do in Chicago? Can he legally deploy the National Guard there?
No. His threats to send troops to invade Chicago is a terrifying, unconstitutional overreach. This is really threatening the use of the military against its own citizens, against the will of local officials. This is the kind of stuff of dictators and authoritarian regimes, fundamental threats to fundamental principles in America, the very things that make us America. You see, our system of federalism is embodied by the 10th Amendment, which says that powers that are not expressly delegated to the federal government by the Constitution are reserved both to the states and to the people. Addressing things like local crime, that's left to local officials. The federal government doesn't get to come in and declare a takeover of Chicago police. That's just not how our Constitution works. There's no active rebellion or insurrection in Chicago, as you reported. Violent crime's down. And so sending Customs Border Patrol, which is the current plans in residential Chicago neighborhoods, neighborhoods that aren't even located on any border or point of entry in the United States, as a pretext to deploy military on a great American city, violates our country's founding principles. And I expect that the courts will see the invasion for the pretext that it is, a power grab to retaliate against cities and states that don't support his political agenda. As you noted, I want to ask something here.
I mean, it hasn't stopped. The questions of the legal nature of this hasn't stopped him in other places. Obviously, D.C. is different. You know, it has this unique status as a federal district. So legally, what the president can do here is different than what he can do in any U.S. state. But he also deployed in Los Angeles. They're appealing that ruling that ruled that that was illegal. So these two moves, do they set a precedent for an increased federal footprint in law enforcement now across the U.S.?
Yeah, it's terrifying. There hasn't been anything like this since troops were sent in at the times of desegregation to protect fundamental federal interest. And there are a potentially disturbing precedent, and a precedent that I don't expect that courts will buy into because it violates these fundamental principles, is that it's permissible and okay to use the military to conduct ordinary local law enforcement. As Judge Breyer recognized in Los Angeles, that's precisely when courts can step in. When called upon, courts have the power to act to stop the executive when it steps beyond its authority.
Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, said Chicago can expect to see immigration enforcement action this week, and that could include National Guard deployments. Would immigration enforcement give the administration any legal cover to send in the National Guard without the governor of Illinois' consent?
Yeah, that's precisely the strategy. And what I hope is that courts will see beyond immigration enforcement as a pretext. It's uncontroversial that federal law enforcement can enforce federal law. Federal immigration agents can enforce federal immigration law. But to use that as a pretext to bring in the military is something that's frightening and is certainly inspiring both terror and courage in Chicago at the same time.
How do you think your city will react if military troops show up?
Yeah, well, I've seen both terror and remarkable courage. The president's declaration of war in Chicago with, as you said, images of the city's skyline on fire. It's terrifying. It's designed to inspire fear, but it's also bringing people together. People are coming together to say, not in our city. This is our red line. This is anathema to all that we hold dear as a city, all that we hold dear as a nation. And so what I expect is that the people of the city to stand strong and protect one another. I also expect the city and state leaders who have long been preparing to fight against this presence to stand alongside the people of Chicago and take legal action.
Craig Futterman is a law professor at the University of Chicago. Thank you for your time and your insights, Craig.
Thanks so much for having me, Leo.
Brazil's Independence Day was marked by protests Sunday in support of former President Jair Bolsonaro. The Trump ally is on trial for allegedly plotting a coup after losing his 2022 re-election bid. A verdict is expected this week. Julia Carneiro has this report.
On São Paulo's Paulista Avenue, crowds chanted Brazil's independence hymn, to free the homeland or to die for Brazil. People here are demanding amnesty for Jair Bolsonaro and his supporters on trial over the violent January 8 riots in Brasília in 2023. Protester Fátima Silva says Bolsonaro isn't receiving a fair trial.
I know that they want to condemn him. We are going to fight until the end to see him free.
On stage, Bolsonaro's wife, Michele Bolsonaro, and political allies addressed the crowds.
Chega do abuso!
São Paulo Governor Tarcísio de Freitas shouts enough abuse, accusing Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, who's leading the case, of tyranny. The crowds respond with chants of out with Moraes.
Fora Moraes! Fora Moraes!
Among all the Brazilian flags, there are also many American flags. President Trump has called Bolsonaro's trial a witch hunt and imposed 50% tariffs on Brazilian exports in retaliation. Many here still hail Trump as a savior, including protesters like Alexandre Brasil.
We are very grateful to Mr. Trump because with these kind of actions, this is helping our people to wake up.
But in the capital, Brasilia, Independence Day sent a different message, with banners reading Sovereign Brazil. In his address, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva defended the country's independence.
Não somos e não seremos novamente colônia de ninguém.
Lula said Brazil was nobody's colony and would not accept orders from anyone. The trial in the Supreme Court resumes on Tuesday. Bolsonaro is facing 5 charges, including attempting to violently end the democratic rule of law and plotting a coup. Now, Brazil waits as a historic trial for its young democracy heads toward a verdict. If found guilty, Bolsonaro could be sentenced to up to 40 years in prison. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in São Paulo.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:19. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, it is National Native News, and then Laura Erickson speaking for the birds, wondering why do birds migrate at night? And now a message from the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988, with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. Mostly sunny today, highs in the upper 60s, and tomorrow slight chance of rain, partly sunny with highs in the upper 60s. Support comes from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pequegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. And we thank ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January, but the deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local Extension office. We continue with Morning Edition.
NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance. From filing returns to tracking assessments, learn more at avalara.com/property tax. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Summer is winding down, and the transition to fall can be a little unsettling.
Though we gotta say goodbye for the summer.
The weather's not really hot anymore, but it's not really cold either. Now, we can't tell you what to wear or even what to do, but we can help you with what to eat.
This is an interesting sort of time of year. We sometimes call it like a shoulder season, kind of the season between seasons. You're looking for something usually a little bit heartier, a little bit richer. And I have a recipe for you that I think just totally checks all of those boxes.
That's Dan Souza, Chief Content Officer for America's Test Kitchen. And he showed me how to make a delicious goodbye to summer, welcome to autumn recipe.
It's white beans and chorizo with this beautiful quick marinated tomatoes and onion. It is one of our most popular trending recipes right now. And I think it will be for the next, you know, probably the next month as we're in this sort of interesting shoulder season.
I was in my kitchen in Los Angeles. Dan was in Boston keeping a watchful and wary eye over me on Zoom.
So we're going to start things off by making this sort of really quick marinade. We're going to start with 3 tablespoons of sherry vinegar. It's got deep savoriness to it, a beautiful, rich, dark color. And it's really nice in a marinade like this.
Okay, 3 tablespoons of sherry vinegar.
Great. Okay, so then you're going to add 1 tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil.
So here is a kind of a dumb question, Dan. Only because I've been always dying to know this. What makes olive oil extra virgin?
So there's rules around this. And basically, when you pick olives and you go to squeeze them, essentially, to get the oil out of them, you can do it cold with just manual pressure. And that oil that comes out first without anything else added to the process, that is extra virgin. And you can then add heat. You can add different processes to it to extract more oil. But in doing so, you are losing a ton of volatile flavors. You're losing a lot of complexity. So extra virgin olive oil is that first cold pressing, and it is packed with flavor. And that's why it's much more expensive. That's why it's kind of coveted.
Okay. So I was thinking about, like, if I'm going to start a new business, what if I say I have extra, extra virgin olive oil?
That might be, if you had extra, extra virgin olive oil, it might still be in the olive.
Oh, olive oil. You heal our hearts with every pour, a brand new star. From the tip of the spoon to the pan, you float.
And so for the next component here, we're going to work with some Spanish-style chorizo. We're going to cook it, which is going to crisp it up and get a lot more flavor to it, and also render out a lot of fat. And that fat is going to be orange and beautiful, and that's going to coat and season everything in the dish. So we're going to do this by starting with 2 tablespoons of olive oil, and we're going to heat it up just until it starts to shimmer. This is a visual cue we use a lot in our recipes to tell when a pan is hot enough for sauteing. And so you start to see these little ripples in the oil on the surface. And when it's shimmering, it's a great temperature to cook onions and vegetables and things like that. You'll hear a nice sizzle when things go in.
Sizzle. They told me it's all you can eat.
Now, as this is happening, you can see that the oil that you started with is now starting to turn kind of a beautiful red color. So what's really nice is a lot of the flavor in the chorizo is also leaching out into that oil. A lot of the flavors in there are fat soluble. And so when you surround them with hot fat, the fat will absorb it. And that way it's going to spread throughout the dish, really provide that smoky, garlicky, really beautiful chorizo flavor in every bite, even if you're not taking an actual bite of chorizo.
Could this work with a vegan chorizo of some kind? Because I notice how like the fat is playing such a big role in how this dish was constructed and how it's going to taste. So I'm wondering, can a vegan chorizo work?
Yeah, vegan sausages have plenty of fat. It's just not an animal source. That fat is going to pick up all the flavor that's in that sausage and it's going to leach it out.
You know, we've done vegan things before, you and I. We did an Impossible Burger. We've used Beyond Meat. But, I'm seeing how Beyond Meat, the company, and Impossible Burger both are struggling a little bit. And I'm wondering, is that something that's been a bit of a surprise, considering how so many people turned to these kinds of products over the last few years?
Yeah, we're constantly seeing shifts in tastes. And I always think of it as sort of pendulum swings. Like we're never really quite in the middle. It's always a little to this extreme and a little to that extreme. So I think there will absolutely be a continued audience there.
Dan, one of the things that I also hear from people too is that they want to eat healthy. So they're looking at these vegan options, these vegan companies that make patties and things that substitute for meat. But the people read labels and they look like they're going back to chemistry class.
Yeah, animal protein is a very complex thing. What they've achieved is actually pretty incredible with some of these products that really can mimic it in a way that like even a staunch carnivore is like, oh wow, this is actually a really good burger. But to get there is a lot of processing that goes into it. You have to make some really informed decisions.
Now if you want something that's good and hot, just eat a hamburger, it'll hit the spot. You can see them on the griddle going flippity-flop. Makes you want to do the boogie to the hamburger hop. They're open up.
Let me give you a look-see here of what it looks like. You can see somehow.
That looks beautiful.
Yeah, the change of color is really cool. To see just the bean just soak up the fat left behind by the chorizo. It looks like a painting, Dan. The colors just pop all over the place.
Isn't it so beautiful? It feels like late summer, It really gives those vibes. You see the tomatoes and that green. So it feels really, really fresh. But there's a heartiness to it, too, that really hints at the fall and kind of what is to come.
Give it a test taste really quick. I got to get at least one chorizo into the taste. Dan, it kind of landed perfectly. I mean, I'm never one to say no to salt, but it kind of landed perfectly on its feet, like a gymnast doing a flip, not needing a little extra to stay upright.
Well, that's what we pride ourselves on. We do so much testing here that we want to make sure it sticks the landing for you.
It's really good. It's really, really good. I can't wait to, I was going to say eat the rest of it, but I guess I have to share some of it with the other people in the house. So I'll try to my best to share some of it. That is Dan Souza, Chief Content Officer for America's Test Kitchen. Dan, thank you very much for helping me out with this one today.
Yeah, thanks again. This was great.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has sounded the alarm about an increase in malicious cyber attacks targeting American water systems.
It's kind of scary that I'm the only door between, the Iranians and their water system. Kind of makes me a little nervous.
How one New England town is defending from digital attacks. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered coming up at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXC. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 6:29. Thanks for listening to the Monday morning show here on People Powered KAXC. I am Jennifer Barr. Taking a look at our current temperatures, we've got a range of 37 in Hibbing up to 49 in Brainerd. That is quite the range. 41 in Grand Rapids, 44 in Aiken, 46 in Park Rapids. For today, we can expect increasing clouds as we go throughout the day. Chance of showers by late afternoon. High 68 to 74. Winds from the south 5 to 10, gusting higher. For tonight, showers are likely. Lows 55 to 60. Patchy fog after midnight. And tomorrow, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms early, then gradually clearing with highs in the low 70s. Our lows tomorrow night near 55. And looking ahead to Wednesday, mostly sunny. Highs near 75. You can answer our question of the week. What TV shows have you been into lately? They can be new or old. You can text us 218-326-1234. Support for KAXE comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at atchisontire.com. In just a moment, we'll hear National Native News and then Laura Erickson speaking for the birds today. Laura's going to talk about nocturnal migration. Also coming up at 7:45, it's another installment of What We're Reading. Staff librarian Tammy Bobrowski talks with Minnesota writer Tasha Coryell about her new thriller, Matchmaking for Psychopaths.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Bureau of Indian Affairs offices in Wisconsin and Minnesota remain open after the Department of Government Efficiency targeted them for termination. As Danielle Kading reports, the initiative formerly led by billionaire Elon Musk had proposed canceling leases for several offices earlier this year.
The cancellations affected offices in Ashland and Shawnee in Wisconsin and Bemidji in Minnesota. Wisconsin tribes say the Bureau of Indian Affairs office in Ashland is a critical regional hub that processes land trust applications and provides education assistance and law enforcement support. Robert Blanchard is chair of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. He says closing the office would have been a hardship for the tribe.
We would have probably had to go maybe Minneapolis or some other place further away from us to get services.
Bill Broidrick represents the owner of the Ashland office. He says Wisconsin tribes adopted a resolution in opposition to its closure.
On that basis, the decision was made by the Bureau of Indian Affairs to keep the office open.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs says all three offices remain open. The agency says it's working to ensure adequate space continues to be available to support delivery of services to tribes. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A site on Douglas Island could be the future home of a casino-like gambling hall due to a proposal from the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. The proposal was approved by the National Indian Gaming Commission. Tlingit and Haida says the facility's approval represents a step toward economic self-sufficiency and sovereignty for the tribe. KTOO's Clarice Larson has more.
The land is on Fish Creek Road, not far from Eagle Crest Ski Area on Douglas Island. It's just a small piece of a native allotment owned by tribal members who lease it to Tlingit and Haida. Tlingit and Haida spokesperson Dixie Hutchinson confirmed that the tribe is developing a gaming facility. The tribe intends to offer Class 2 gaming, which covers things like pull tabs, bingo, and slot-style electronic machines. The National Indian Gaming Commission's acting chair approved the tribe for site-specific gaming at the location in January. The decision came just days before President Donald Trump began his second term in office. For decades, federal officials and state officials in Alaska have said that native allotments owned by tribal members in Alaska were not considered Indian country. Therefore, they are not under the jurisdiction of tribes and cannot be home to casinos or casino-like gaming halls under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. But Michelle Jockathot Demert, a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Tribal Governance Department, says the legal interpretation of native allotments shifted when President Joe Biden came into office.
During the Biden administration, there was a solicitor's opinion that evaluated the laws and made the determination that the laws supported that Indian tribes in Alaska have jurisdiction over allotments.
She says gaming serves as an important governmental function for many tribes in the U.S.
You know, people look at it that it's just this big money-making operation, but it's so much more than that. It's an opportunity to make money and an opportunity to put that right back into your governmental system to provide essential services to your citizens.
Hutchinson says the project is still in the early phases of development. She says the tribe intends to reinvest the gaming hall's revenue into essential tribal programs and services. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation with funding from the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. Hear the latest edition today at 4:30 during All Things Considered. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. You are listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. Support comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, host of the Martini Monday Music Series. Rich Matson and Jermaine Gemberling perform this evening from 5 to 8. This acoustic duo features country, folk, and rock classics. More information at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Weather today, increasing clouds with a chance of showers by late afternoon, high 68 to 74, winds from the south 5 to 10, gusting higher. Showers likely overnight, lows 55 to 60, patchy fog after midnight and into the early morning. And we do have a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms early tomorrow, then gradually clearing, highs in the low 70s, and for Wednesday, mostly sunny, highs near 75. Time to hear from Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
Most birds are diurnal, that is, they're active in the daytime.
We are having trouble with this file from Laura Erickson, so we're going to hear a different version of For the Birds. She's talking about how she met her husband 60 years ago this week.
See well at
exactly
night.
Exactly 60
we know
years
that
ago this
exactly
week
when on high school freshman registration day when I was 13 years old, I got a huge crush on the boy sitting in front of me in homeroom. In the same way that adolescent geese, swans, and cranes meet their lifetime partners when large flocks gather and hang out through the months that coincide with much of a school year, high school becomes the human form of a big mixed flock. Russ and I had a lot of classes together, became debate partners, and were both members of the science club and a social group that formed around that interest in science. Some geese, swans, and cranes single out the mate they'll stick with for life during their first winter together, but some take years to know who they might be compatible with, and many make a bunch of false starts in courtship before things grow serious. Russ, the more methodical, less impulsive half of our partnership, waited 3 years to ask me out. But long before our first date, exactly 57 years ago, on August 30th, 1968, we had a lot of shared history and a solid friendship. People often quote Leo Tolstoy's opening sentence of Anna Karenina, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way," as if it's a sacred truism. But Tolstoy got it only half right. Every happy family and every happy marriage is happy in its own way, too. People who understand and appreciate the natural world understand and appreciate diversity among and within species, including our own. So I have absolutely no advice for anyone about love and commitment because we're all different. We love who we love and muddle through life hoping for the best, each dealing with our own unique sets of hardships, difficulties, interests, passions, passions, strengths, and weaknesses. And we each change over time in ways that no 13-year-old child smitten with puppy love could anticipate. If things haven't always gone well between us, they usually have, and the worst of the rough patches decades ago left us with greater love and appreciation for each other. I was not a birder when we got married. Indeed, I'd never heard of a field guide and didn't realize that regular people could own binoculars. We didn't have enough money for Christmas gifts for each other back then, but it was Russ's idea to tell his mom to buy me binoculars and a field guide for Christmas in 1974. Russ knew me well enough to be pretty sure I'd enjoy birding, but how could he possibly have guessed that I'd immediately become monomaniacal about it? During the years when he was working on his master's and PhD, we were both consumed with our own concerns while supporting the other as well as we could. I read and helped edit every word of his master's thesis and PhD dissertation, which he wrote with me in mind. He wanted his work to be understandable for people in other disciplines, too. He came along on some of my Michigan Audubon field trips, even though he wasn't a birder, and I went along on some of his field research data collecting jaunts. Birding, and especially big ears, have damaged a lot of marriages. When our kids were still home, Russ had to pretty much stop coming along on my long-distance birding trips, and I had to stop tagging along when he had scientific meetings in birdy places. But we wove birding along with everyone else's interests into our family vacations. Our kids were grown when I did my big year in 2013. I went to a lot of places Russ would have loved to come along to, but just before the year started, his mom, 94 at the time, moved in with us. And because of her dementia, we couldn't leave her for more than a few hours at a time. So during that entire year, Russ was only along for one morning in February when we drove up to Two Harbors and stumbled upon the closest, most cooperative boreal owl we've ever seen, one of my most treasured memories of that entire thrilling year. In the past 3 years, Russ and I have gone together on two trips that were entirely focused on birding, to Alaska and Hawaii. We knew he'd enjoy all the places we visited, even if he wasn't that interested in the birds. Russ will be retiring at the end of the year, and the one thing he's been yearning...
It is 6:42. Thanks for listening to the Monday morning.
His trip, not a dedicated birding tour, so he'll make the plans and arrangements. Just as he got to see beautiful scenery and wildlife in Alaska and Hawaii, I'll get to see plenty of birds in the Galapagos. It's lovely and lucky to still be running side by side with my best friend as we sprint through the final stretches of this lifelong marathon. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can find more at lauraerickson.com. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. About 1 hour from now, it's What We're Reading. Tammy Bobrowski talks with Minnesota writer Tasha Coryell about her new thriller, Matchmaking for Psychopaths. And coming up at 7:20, it's Events Up North. Malachi Coons and I will take a look at many events happening throughout the region this week. You can also find that list right now at KAXE.org. I want to thank everybody who came out to Grand Rapids River Fest on Saturday. We had a great time with you, despite some chilly temps and some rain. It seemed like everyone was enjoying themselves, and music was great as always. So thanks for coming out.
President Trump is threatening to send the National Guard.
Thanks so much for listening to KAXE this morning, and bear with me on this Monday. It certainly is one. Temperatures this morning ranging from the upper 30s in the Hibbing area to the upper 40s in the Brainerd area. Today, our highs will be 68 to 74 and increasing clouds throughout the day. Chance of showers. Winds from the south, 5 to 10, gusting higher. Showers likely tonight, lows 55 to 60, and patchy fog after midnight. Slight chance of showers and thunderstorms early tomorrow, then gradually clearing, highs in the low 70s. And our temperatures tomorrow night near 55, and for Wednesday, mostly sunny with highs near 75. We are going to continue now with news from National Public Radio's Morning Edition.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. The Trump administration plans to release new dietary guidelines in the next few weeks. Health Secretary RFK Jr. has promised the days of skim milk and other low-fat dairy products are over.
There's been an attack on whole milk and cheese and yogurt over the past couple of decades.
That's Kennedy speaking at an event with the dairy industry over the summer. NPR's Will Stone reports on the case for more fat in our dairy.
The U.S. dietary guidelines have long encouraged fat-free or low-fat dairy. The rationale being that full-fat dairy can be a significant source of saturated fat, which in turn raises cholesterol. But Richard Bruno says the thinking in his field has evolved with more studies. Bruno is a professor of human nutrition at Ohio State University.
The saturated fat from dairy foods doesn't seem to be behaving the way we think it should behave based on that historical evidence that saturated fat is linked to heart disease.
Meaning how you get that saturated fat matters. Research suggests the dairy fat matrix has different effects on your health compared to the same amount of fat from meat or other foods.
There seems to be other bioactive components in that matrix that alleviate any putative risk that would be associated with that higher intake of saturated fat.
Now, dairy is a broad category, so it's hard to make sweeping statements. For example, if someone eats a diet high in butter, technically dairy, you get the negative consequences on cholesterol. But if you replace butter with cheese, you don't see that.
Yogurt is different from milk, is different from cheese, making interpretation of research studies very complicated in the absence of controlled trials.
So after years of controversy, Benoit Lamarche, who studies nutrition at the University Laval in Quebec, came together with other experts to see whether the recommendations in the U.S. and Canada were justified.
If we are saying that low fat is better than high fat, we should have studies demonstrating that. Black and white.
He says they concluded the evidence against high-fat dairy is circumstantial. Earlier studies showed people at higher risk of heart disease tended to eat more full-fat dairy, but there were other factors and patterns in their diet that could explain that.
With that in mind, where is the comparison, direct comparison between low and high-fat dairy on health? No evidence. The evidence is showing that they have the same effect, and the evidence is of low quality, and there's just a few studies that have looked at that.
There are even some small studies suggesting whole-fat dairy may be more beneficial, particularly when part of a healthy eating pattern. Also, cheese, which is high in fat, is associated with a lower risk of stroke. On whole milk versus skim, Lamarche says the evidence is slim in either direction. Overall, his view is it's too soon to take a strong stance one way or the other on high-fat versus low-fat dairy.
One could argue, well, what's the harm in promoting low-fat dairy? It's not going to kill anyone, for sure. My perspective really is diet is so complicated. Let's focus on the big issues and not distract people with something for which we're not sure.
As it stands, most Americans don't actually eat the recommended amount of dairy. Frank Hu, a professor of nutrition at Harvard, says a modest amount of dairy, full or low fat, is fine. What matters most is your diet as a whole.
If you replace the refined carbohydrates and sugar with dairy products, even some full-fat dairy products, that's probably a good thing.
He believes there's room for all sorts of dairy in a healthy diet. Will Stone, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in 3 new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to KAXE and the Monday Morning Show. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up just after 7 o'clock, we'll have the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local news stories and conversations at our website, kaxe.org. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. There is more ahead from Morning Edition here on People Powered Kate.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. By now, you've probably heard about the Trump administration's efforts to ramp up deportations of undocumented people. And those efforts go beyond raiding workplaces and serving outstanding warrants. Now they've sent the National Guard and surged federal agents into Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., where they've stopped Uber drivers, workers at construction sites and restaurants, and people walking down the street. Critics have always said that U.S. citizens would be caught up in these kinds of indiscriminate actions. And now, one person we've met in Washington, D.C., says it happened to her just over a week ago.
I saw two army policemen or wherever they are. They start looking at me very strange, and I got scared.
She asked us to use her nickname Chilo because she says she's afraid of repercussions from speaking out. She is a naturalized citizen who's lived in the U.S. since she was adopted at age 9 from Nicaragua. Now 53, she's married and the mother of a high school-aged daughter. She got her citizenship at age 14, and she's lived here ever since. She says she was walking past a gas station in her neighborhood on her way to a CVS.
They stopped me, and I asked them what I did wrong. I said, you look like from another, you know, country. And I said, I've been a citizen my whole life. I've been here. I can show you my passport and I can show you my ID. And I'm a citizen. Oh, you don't look like a citizen. You just look like some from another country.
This is why I say that we know that they're profiling. If you are not a white person, you are at risk of being questioned and detained by immigration enforcement.
That is Marissa Montes. She is a professor at Loyola Law School and director of the Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic. Montes lives in Los Angeles, where President Trump deployed National Guard troops after days of protests against immigration raids. She says her clients have been targeted by immigration enforcement.
We're seeing now raids that are being conducted where basically ICE agents are questioning people on the basis of what they look like. So presenting as other nationalities, not just Latino, or speaking other languages.
Chilo told us she thinks that's what happened to her in D.C. because she has black hair and brown skin. She also has a mild learning disability, which can affect her comprehension. She told us the two men wore camouflage and masks. They did not identify themselves, and she says they got all up in her face. How did that make you feel?
Like, I feel I don't belong here.
Hmm.
I don't belong here.
Oh. I'm sorry. Had anyone ever made you feel that way before?
No.
Did they explain why they were stopping you, or did they apologize after they stopped you?
getting apologized.
Did they leave you alone after that?
I just ran to the store.
Oh. Were you scared?
I got scared because I thought they're going to take me away.
Chilo had her real ID and a copy of her U.S. passport with her because her mother, who also lives in D.C., advised her to carry proof of citizenship ever since the immigration raids began. Here's Marissa Montes again.
It is completely illegal for the federal government to detain a U.S. citizen for immigration purposes and to subject them to deportation.
Not only are U.S. citizens not required to carry proof of citizenship, Montes said, they also have the right to know who is questioning them.
You can actually report them to local law enforcement, especially if they're not willing to say who they are, because then they're committing a crime of potentially acting as law enforcement.
But if you are stopped, Montes says, here is some advice.
It's actually the duty of ICE to determine if you are a U.S. national or not, so make them do their work. You might be subject to the detention. But if you're certain that you're a U.S. citizen, and you are, they have to also then prove that you are one.
As for Chilo, she's still upset, but she says,
I don't want them to think they won.
She wants to be able to go out again, just like anybody else.
NPR reached out to the Department of Homeland Security for comment on Chilo's case. DHS Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs Tricia McLaughlin said, quote, allegations ICE law enforcement officers are engaging in racial profiling are disgusting and categorically false. She added that what makes someone a target of ICE is if they are illegally in the U.S., not their skin color, race, or ethnicity.
Hey, A. I want to wish you a happy belated National Grandparents Day.
Oh, nice. Thank you. Yeah, I became a grandpa at 39. I spent all day yesterday washing my granddaughter's clothes.
Sounds like the glam life of a young grandpa. So, washing your granddaughter's clothes, is that your favorite thing about being a grandparent?
No, the best thing about being a grandparent is when their parents come to pick them up so that me and my wife can have some time alone, finally. They spent a lot of time with me lately.
We asked some of you, our listeners and our readers, the same question. What's your favorite thing about being a grandparent? Rebecca Lemos in California says this is one of her favorite things.
When your toddler granddaughter sees you and runs to hug you saying, Grammy, 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 with a huge smile that lights up her eyes.
Arune Pawashi in Connecticut became a grandparent this year. Her grandson's name means ray of light, and she says that's exactly what he is.
Every moment with Kiran has been filled with joy. He feels like the first rays of the morning sun, bringing brightness, warmth, and hope into my life.
Oh, Pawashi says that being a grandmother is a little different from being a mom.
Holding my grandson brings back memories of holding my own children. The difference is that now I can enjoy the tenderness of those moments without the constant responsibilities that parents must shoulder.
Ben Compenine from Massachusetts became a grandfather right before his 80th birthday.
We've come late to the grandparent thing.
He said he and his wife are ready to spend every day with their granddaughter. They even moved states to be closer to her.
At our age, we realize we're unlikely to see her very deep into her life, so we want to create some early memories for her.
We heard from another new grandparent, Michelle Wallace in North Carolina, who became a grandparent just last month. Wallace can't wait to do fun things like take her grandchild to the zoo and the aquarium.
I think that's one way of staying young at heart instead of focusing on my daily struggles.
But she also wants to help her son and his wife however she can, since she's done the whole parenting thing once before.
Be willing to share stories and advice about how your child was cared for or reacted to something, but realize that some things do change.
We have more advice from our listeners and readers for grandparents-to-be at NPR.org. And even though I was a young grandparent, hopefully I don't become a great grandparent for at least another decade. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
It is a minute before 7 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have the Up North report coming up in just a few moments. Coming up at 7:20, Events Up North, a closer look at what's going on throughout northern Minnesota this week. Programming is supported by Grand Dental Center, where doctors Lisa Johnson, Leanna McBride, and their staff provide full-service family dental care for patients of all ages in Grand Rapids and surrounding communities. More information at Grand.